How do you prevent? How do you detect? How do you respond and mitigate? Those are the hallmarks of a strong program. And when you use sort of the blocking and tackling that comes with those programs, it does address a lot of the threat environment.
Welcome to the Flux Capacitor, a podcast about the future of electricity. I'm Francis Bradley of Electricity Canada. This is number 103, episode 103 of the Flux Capacitor. This episode of the pod is both wide-ranging and a deep dive with a security focus this time. My guest on the podcast today is...
So hi, everybody. I'm Manny Cancel. I am Senior Vice President at NERC and the CEO of the ISAC.
Now, let me start with a couple of acronyms Manny and I use throughout the discussion. An ISAC is an Information Sharing and Analysis Center. And in this case, we're talking mainly about the electricity ISAC. And NERC, N-E-R-C, is the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. And the listener will recall that the CEO of NERC, Jim Robb, has been on the podcast a couple of times. Manny joined the podcast for a conversation on the role of the EISAC and what it does to help secure the North American electricity system. We talk about the current and evolving threat environment, the importance of exercises, and learnings from the GridX exercises. We talk about cyber mutual assistance, the importance of partnerships with governments and the vendor community, and what the future may look like for the EISAC. We close the conversation with Manny's two book recommendations. Here is my conversation with Manny Cancel, recorded on Zoom in early December 2024. Manny, it's great to finally get you on the podcast. Welcome.
Well, Francis, thank you for inviting me and thrilled to be here. I've listened to a number of the podcasts and got a lot of great insights from them. So really happy to be here.
Well, I'm delighted that we were able to score the time. But where I thought we'd start would be for the listener who may not be familiar with the ISAC, if you could maybe give us the quick rundown, the elevator pitch on what it is that the ISAC does.
Sure. So we are a security service provider for the electricity industry across North America. So that's both the United States, Canada, and a little bit of Mexico. Mm-hmm. We make sure that the sector is informed about physical and cybersecurity threats, mitigation activities, and other things that are going on. We're made up of about 1,800 members. About 1,600 of those members are utilities across the United States and Canada, as well as though our partners in the federal government, both in the United States and Canada as well, too. And that's a big part of our role, making sure that we support our government partners as we sort of combat the risks that we're facing across the industry.
Yeah. And so how long has the ISAC been around? And there's a number of them in terms of the ISACs, but the electricity ISAC, can you give us a sense of how long this has been playing this role?
Sure. So, you know, I'm happy to be part of this, but this year we celebrated our 25th anniversary.
Wow.
So hard to believe that we spent the last 25 years. And the ISACs, all the critical infrastructure ISACs, were established by a presidential directive in the United States that asked for the development of these, or the creation of these ISACs, to make sure that they're working closely with their respective industries.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So 25 years ago. So this would have been one of the presidential directives under President Clinton. So that's quite some time that there's been the focus in this space. Was there an event that triggered it back in the late 1990s?
You know, I can't think of a particular event. I think you're talking about the very early stages of sort of computer networking, PCs and stuff like that. And we were starting to see things like computer viruses that were mostly limited to PCs and other devices. But I think the more compelling reason for the ISAC is recognizing the dependence on critical infrastructure, you know, the reliance on society, the reliance to the economy, the important role they play in driving the economy. So it's important that these sectors remain secure and remain operating.
Yeah, and you noted that there was a number of sectors that kind of stood up at the time. So even 25 years ago, there was that recognition of the interdependency, I guess, or is that something that's kind of more recent?
Yeah, now there are 16 critical infrastructure sectors now. I don't know if all 16 existed. They did exist, but had their own ISACs
Right.
when they were created. But a number of them, the more substantial one, financial, telecommunications, and so on, were established.
Yeah, okay. All right. And so today, what is the state of play in terms of the threat environment? Because 25 years ago, I was just kind of doing the math, we were still fiddling with Y2K, and as you noted, it was early days of computer viruses. But like the state of play today is very different, and it's moving quickly, isn't it?
Oh, it the complexity, the velocity, the volume of the threat and volume of threat environment is really overwhelming. Again, and unprecedented, and it continues to move in that trajectory. So whether it's the risk posed by nation-state actors, organized criminals who are perpetrating ransomware attacks or other attacks, people who are taking advantage of software vulnerabilities and the number of software and hardware vulnerabilities just continue to climb year by year, and it just really makes it a very challenging environment, even for the best and most mature security programs in our industry.
Yeah. So, where would you kind of place the electricity sector in terms of that maturity when looking across, the 16? We organize ourselves as 10 sectors. I know it's 16 sectors in the United States, but electricity sector, we've been at this for, since Y2K days. Level of maturity, are we at the top, near the top? Where
Yeah,
would
I'd
you kind
like
of
to think
place
we're
us?
near the top. I don't want to make it sound like I'm declaring victory because this is a constantly evolving threat landscape. But this is a sector that just didn't wake up to security risk. We've been aware of security risk, going back to things like Y2K. Certainly 9/11 sensitized us. The blackout, a lot of people forget after the blackout in the Northeast in 2003, just 5 days later, probably the world's first big virus, the I Love You or the Welcher virus, crippled PCs across the world, right? Very similar to the CrowdStrike incident that we saw earlier this year. But this sector has been paying attention to this threat, preparing for this threat, exercising, conducting drills, and really working on developing their capabilities to enhance their resilience.
So you've been at it for 5 years. Or close to 5 years at the ISAC. Before that, though, you were not a stranger to this space, right? You were CIO at Con Ed, and I recall you were involved in NERC and NERC activities prior to your joining the company when you were still at Con Ed, weren't you?
Yes, I was. Yeah. So yeah, I was. I retired as a CIO and had security responsibilities there. Had a number of operational roles prior to that, but yeah, was very involved through our trade associations with NERC and the activities there. And I actually had to sign off on NERC SIP compliance for Con Ed. So very familiar with the space and what we had to deal with, and certainly being in New York City. Not that anybody isn't, but we were hypersensitized to the threat environment, being the rich target that New York is for potential threat actors.
It just occurred to me, because you've mentioned some of the events that have occurred over the last several years. You were with Con Ed during 9/11, so World Trade Center was one of your customers. What was that experience? Must have been. I can't even imagine what it would have been like for you and the other people at Con Ed.
Yeah, I won't go on too long about it, but I remember the day like everybody remembers days like this. It's etched in my brain. We were going to a meeting, and that morning we learned that one of the towers were hit. Thought it was just an accident, but when the second tower was hit, we knew. We were about a mile away from the towers. I didn't go home that night. I spent the night, helping our crews out at Ground Zero. So certainly those memories, those visions. are always going to be with me. Lost a number of friends that I went to high school and college with, and that's the human part of it. But the silver lining out of it is that, again, we were made more resilient. That was the start of a real focused discussion on how we better prepare for physical attacks. How do we harden our infrastructure? How do we make it more fault tolerant and resilient? And so, as bad a situation it was, as that was, it really was to be a watershed moment in some respects in the security realm.
Listen, one of the things I ask folks that come on the podcast is about their journey. And so, I often make the joke when you were a kid on the playground, Manny, did you always dream of being in the electricity space and being in the security space? What was your journey into this sector?
Well, I still, hold out hopes for becoming a Major League Baseball player, but my time is running out. But, I've always been a bit of a math and science guy. That is what my undergrad education is. Was lucky enough to get into Con Ed, and was also lucky enough to, do a diversity of things there, from operations to customer service to audit, eventually into IT and led some very big IT projects there. And again, just understanding the business of energy and what we do. So really it was a great opportunity. So I can't, point to one thing that pointed me in that direction. In some respects it was serendipity and kind of worked out that way. But as I learned more about the industry, I really d enjoyed working at it. And I one thing I say to people now, when I joined this industry 40 something years ago, quasi-governmental, slow to change, stuff like that. Now the pace of change here, not only in the security landscape, but just the pace and change in the energy industry is tremendous, right? And so what was probably a dull industry is now one of the coolest industries to work in.
Pace of change. We were talking about that earlier this week at an event I was at, and I kind of asked a couple of people who were at the event, who 6 months ago would have even imagined that we'd be talking about restarting Three Mile Island to provide power to data centers in terms of how quickly things have changed. But I mean, things have changed as well in the space where you are at the ISAC, right? The speed and the pace. How do you keep up? And more importantly, how are we going to keep up in in the future as with AI and more tools that are available to everybody?
Yeah, you're right. As I said before, it can be overwhelming, but I think the elements of a mature program, which is really thinking about how do you detect, how do you respond? Well, take a step back. How do you prevent? How do you detect? How do you respond and mitigate? Those are the hallmarks of a strong program. And when you use sort of the blocking and tackling that comes with those programs, it does address a lot of the threat environment. The other thing is that there are some basics, things like multi-factor authentication, strong passwords, network segmentation. This is sort of like the spinach and vegetables that, if you do, you stand quite a fighting chance of keeping the most even the most pernicious threats away. But that being said, some of these threats are coming from very sophisticated adversaries, nation states. Which is not really a fair fight. Most corporate environments were not set up to sort of protect themselves against that level of threat actor. But that's where working as an industry and working with our government partners, we can do more to make sure that we stay protected.
And one of those ways that we work together has been the exercise that you and the team at the EISAC have been running for a number of years, have been those GridX exercises. Can you maybe reflect a little bit for us in terms of how important those have been, and what are some of the real big learnings that have come out of GridX the last several years?
Yeah, I think they're critically important. And we conduct this exercise every 2 years. It has grown to be the biggest grid security exercise in North America and arguably the world. It involves a great number of people over 3 days. So at our last exercise, GridX 7, over 15,000 people participated in distributed play. And then this culminates in what we call an executive tabletop, which brings the industry leaders, as well as the government leaders in the United States and Canada of key agencies. And we talk about how we would respond to a serious threats. We've always learned something from GridX. I've had the pleasure of being a participant in every GridX, whether as a player or now as the person throwing the party. But you know, an example of some of the things that we've learned is, and it may sound obvious, but we were able to better articulate some of the critical interdependencies between other sectors. So, for example, natural gas, and now natural gas, the natural gas sector actually plays in GridX, right? In addition to some of the other critical infrastructure sectors like finance and telecom. The creation of what we call the Cyber Mutual Assistance Program, which is a program very bespoke that essentially copies what we do in storm restoration, where we have mutual assistance agreements across the United States, across Canada, to, you know, where we can now dispatch crews to help restore jurisdictions after a major storm. So CMA is the same thing, but you don't have to travel, you don't have to send trucks, you can just leverage the expertise, and there is quite a level of expertise across our industry to kind of help with a serious a cyber threat. So it all the you know appropriate non-disclosure and legal agreements are in place, and really all somebody has to do is make a request for help.
And then you've been involved, if memory serves me, you've been involved in cyber mutual assistance since when you were at Con Ed. It sounds like a really, really good idea. Have we actually seen it in action, and is it working?
So yes, you know, so the ISAC itself is not part of the program. It is really for the utilities, but I am aware of the fact that the utilities have used it. Fortunately, not very often, right? It's designed for very serious incidents where you need to bring people together. So yes, I am aware. And again, I think it's a construct that it's good to have in place. We don't necessarily want to figure it out when we're in the midst of a crisis. But it also gets back to the way we're structured. And I know, Francis, you're aware of this, being a member of the Electricity Subsector Coordinating Council, which helps to just facilitate, you know, decision making and also progress on these initiatives, right? You know, so they're a body that really drives us forward in terms of improving our overall resilience to cyber and physical security threats.
Let me go back to GridX, because we talked a little bit about that. Are there anything any issues that keep coming up, when you're doing your hot wash and in the after action reports? Are there things that that keep landing in those after action reports that are sort of persistent issues that are sticky and difficult for us to address?
Sure, I'd cite three, and while they're, you know, at their root, they're basically the same issue. There's always a nuance in each exercise. So one is communications. Are you communicating with the right people? You know, stakeholders, customers, the press, government resources. Who do you need to communicate? What do you need to communicate? Maintaining unity of effort and unity of message across the sector is really important. The second one is restoration priorities, right? You know, every event is different, and you know, the impact events, you know, are different. You know, how do we sort of structure our restoration plans to make sure that it is the most effective it can be? And how do we explain that as we go forward? And then the last one that always comes up is what we call resilient communications. You know, GridX is designed to actually break the grid, and we inject really serious scenarios that, that really challenge us, and one being the loss of communication, which, as you know, is really vital in any kind of restoration effort. You know, communications between parties to help organize and synchronize, and we saw this most recently during Hurricanes Helene and Milton here in the United States, where you did see communication substantially disrupted, and which hampered restoration. And again, kind of underscores the need for very tight interaction and partnership with our partners in the telecommunications industry.
And that one keeps coming up. I recall resilient communication. And is one of the reasons because the technologies that we're depending upon are evolving as well? We're not even using the same networks today as we were using, 2 or 3 grid axes ago when we were on, 4G and LTE, and things are constantly shifting. Does that add an additional layer of challenge?
I think it adds a layer of challenge, but I also think it's an opportunity because you're right. Technology keeps evolving. Some companies make investments to use those technologies. Other companies are not able. So one of the things we're doing in response to the last grid axe to really try to make more deliberate progress on this is developing an inventory of communications capabilities using this construct called PACE, primary, alternate, contingency, and emergency. And we've never had this catalog before, but the thinking is here, if we have the catalog, if we know what exists, we can know what we move on to depending on the scenario. And the other thing that you just alluded to is how do we take advantage of new technologies? And we have already things like Tesla Starlink, which has been used for storm restoration, was used in Milton and Helene. It's been used for other use cases as well too. The use of drones in for damage assessment, which I would say is actually mainstream now. But those are things that could be done. There are other out-of-band communications networks that have been developed that sort of essentially plug into what's existing. And then lastly, I'd say several utilities, including utilities in Canada, have made their own investments in their own telecommunications infrastructure, whether they're leveraging their own fiber right of ways and so on and so forth to enable communications with crews and other entities.
And one of the other things that I believe the ISAC does is you basically have like a watch desk that you're constantly monitoring events as they take place. So what does that look like? Because that's got to be a challenge to maintain.
It is a challenge to maintain, but I'm proud of what we put together. We do have a 24 by 7 watch operations center, which is staffed by analysts, both cyber and physical security analysts, who sort of monitor various intelligence sources, op mostly open source. We also monitor the dark web and look for indicators of compromise. So, for example, criminals that conduct ransomware campaigns will often brag on the dark web that they have executed an attack. There have been many times when the ISAC has seen that and notified companies that, hey, you may want to look into this. And we've given them a heads up on that sort of stuff. But we also, try to get ahead of threats and make sure, as I said earlier, that the industry is aware. And a good example is when the CrowdStrike incident took place a few months ago. That graveyard shift, so to speak, that was working on the ISAC was able to develop communications and get messaging out there. When we knew more about that, what the cause of that was, we were also able to get that out there as well. So maintaining that, latest level of knowledge and status is very, very important. And I think that's a payback that the watch provides.
So what does that watch look like? I mean, it's not, you don't have like eight guys that take turns around a desk in Washington, right? I don't, so you've got folks pretty much spread in different time zones and
Well, we initially, when the watch was established, it was just like any other security operations center. We not quite eight, it was I think five or six. And you had people sitting in sort of a control center. The pandemic has had us rethink this, and we are largely virtual. So we have a virtual SOC. We do have office space in Washington where we convene the SOC on occasion. But one of the benefits of having this virtual SOC is being able to sort of have people all over the country, right? And follow the sun, so to speak. So we can serve our East Coast customers, our Midwest customers, and obviously our West Coast, and sort of increase the number of hours we're actually in operations. So we sort of stagger our schedule to provide a broad level of coverage. At night, we compress that. There's not as many people at night. There's generally one or two people who do that. And the same with weekends and holidays.
Right. But even weekends and holidays and overnight, there is a watch that's taking place. Because I mean, I recall probably right about the time that you had joined the ISAC. It wasn't 24/7 just yet. And so that's
No,
something
that
that.
took place about about 6 months into my tenure, right? And it grew, by the way, getting back to the GridX conversation, it grew out of GridX. It
Wow.
also grew out of recommend it we have a customer advisory board, which you're familiar with, called the Member Executive Committee. They had asked us to establish this. So again, something we were thinking about, but was actually reinforced by our membership, the need to do so. And it has paid dividends. It definitely has.
No, absolutely. And what about the connections with the other ISACs? Is there like a formal linkage when you see something on the watch desk? It's clearly certainly signaled to our community. But what do the interconnections look like with the ISACs in, I don't know, finance and telecommunications and the other sectors that we're kind of interdependent with?
Yeah, it's actually quite robust, and just as you illustrated, we will reach out to the cr other critical infrastructure sectors to say, and often they know about it, but we want to make sure, hey, are you aware of something? Or if we see something, like I said, on the dark web that may be that may claim to be compromising another sector, we make sure we show you that. So that is done formally. It's part of our procedures. We have this construct that we call the Tri-Sector Playbook, where we formally mobilize the ISACs together to share information. And it's kind of a misnomer. We call it tri-sector, but it's more like four or five sectors. It's gas, telecom, finance. Occasionally, we'll bring in other sectors as well, too. But, examples of us using this were the invasion of Ukraine, and other serious incidents where we want to maintain, situational awareness across the sector. And the great thing about doing this, when you think about other ISACs, like financial services or telecommunications, these are global ISACs, right? They have members that work all over the place. And during the Ukraine invasion and war, they have assets in Ukraine, right? And in Russia too. So they can speak to what's going on there and provide insights that we don't normally deal with. More formally, there is the National Council of ISACs, which is a compendium of ISACs that meets here in Washington on a monthly basis, where we not only trade or share threat intelligence, but we get briefs from the government. We talk about pertinent issues. We talk about upcoming legislation as well too, and how we want to react to it. So again, always room for improvement, but pretty robust level of interaction that takes place.
So how big is the team now? Spread across now the different time zones, but it's not an insignificant little team anymore. It is a
No, we've grown to be about 56 employees and contractors across the United States. We are currently have resources in 17 states in the union,
Wow.
which again provides that breadth of coverage that I mentioned earlier. So yeah, the team has grown substantially over the last couple of years. A lot of that has been response to the changing threat environment, right? So I anticipate that'll continue. We've also pivoted from pushing information out to doing more analysis, right? And I think you'll continue to see more of this, what threat hunts we do in various intelligence sources. The promise of AI, provides some opportunities are there as well. So you'll see us doing more as it relates to that.
Well, and where do you get people to, where are you recruiting people? I don't recall, seeing ads anywhere for organizations like yours seeking to recruit people to monitor the dark web. It's not like a common classified ad you see for a job, because it's pretty specialized, some of the work that you do.
It is specialized. These are mostly intelligence, people with a background in that sort of stuff, or cyber, security, cyber forensics, stuff like that, cyber auditing. We also have a really strong and robust physical security team, right? Which is a discipline in and of itself. You might say intelligence is intelligence, but they
Yeah.
really specialize in how you can protect, physically protect assets from theft, from vandalism, from ballistic damage, and stuff like that. We're fortunate in the sense that we get these people from the intelligence community, from the military, from the federal government as well, too, people who are looking. I think our location in Washington, or at least our headquarters in Washington, helps with that. You know, there's quite a concentration of those resources here. But, you know, I'm proud to say we do have people from all over. And there are many robust educational programs across the United States and Canada where, you know, you have universities that really specialize in this sort of stuff. So we're able to recruit from those areas as well.
Listen, one of the first times that you and I chatted, once you took on this role, you'd come up to Ottawa. Man, it must have been just before the pandemic began. It was probably days before. And the one of the reasons why we were meeting was to try and look how we could improve the collaboration with agencies in Ottawa. How's that gone? Because that was, I guess, roughly the time that we were looking at the Government of Canada standing up the Canadian Cyber Centre. That relationship has flourished, I imagine. I think it's going well, hasn't it?
I think it's absolutely flourished. As a matter of fact, we share and we meet with the Canadian Cyber Center on a regular basis. You know, my analysts and their analysts meet and compare and discuss threat intelligence. We participate in their Geek Week
Right.
hacking exercise every year. You know, which is a great, you know, collaboration. But just more importantly, the information sharing that takes place is quite robust. You know, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the work with the Natural Resources Canada, Public Safety Canada, and you know, you and your colleagues at Electricity Canada deserve a lot of the credit for helping to broker these relationships. We have IOUs with, I mean, MOUs, Memorandum of Understanding with the Independent Electricity System Operator in Ontario, with the Ontario Energy Board and other Canadian organizations, you know.
Right.
So I again don't want to declare the victory, but quite pleased with the way that has matured, and we want to keep those lines of communications open.
So what's the future going to look like for the ISAC if we project ahead to 2030, 2035? How clearly the environment within which they're operating is going to change. I don't know, we'll be in a world of AI and quantum computing. But is the ISAC going to change, or will it be the same, only more advanced and smarter?
Well, I think it'll be a little bit of that. Yeah, certainly advanced and smarter. I think our the way we do what we do has to shift. I think we do a really good job of getting information out on a timely and actionable basis. So that's a boon, and it could be a curse too, because there's so much information to get out. So I think we can be more deliberate about how we curate information, how we focus people on the most important threats, how we do more threat hunting, and whether that's through, you know, analytics or AI, how we partner with our technology community, right? The technology community is very important. We all use these tools, right? And working with them to get their, you know, learn from them, their understanding of the threat environment, what they're seeing, I think is important as well too. One of the things you've seen over the last few years is providing more bespoke services, depending. You know, we serve a diversity of utilities, large investor-owned utilities, the Canadian Crown companies, but also a big swath of public power and small municipally run and cooperative utilities, right? All with different needs, all with different capabilities. And so we have to make sure that we're responsive to all those needs. So those will be the big areas of focus for the ISAC. And the last thing I would just draw your attention to, Francis, is we are a stakeholder organization. We have to be very customer focused, right? So we have a specific customer experience initiative going on where we're getting feedback from our customers regarding what I just talked about. How do you want to ingest information? On what basis? You know, what's useful, what's not useful, right? And we really see a lot coming out of this initiative over the next year. So I'm looking forward to that.
I got to say, that's one of the The significant changes I've seen at the ISAC since you came on board was this understanding of and focus on being a customer service organization. I don't think I heard it expressed in those terms, prior to 2020. I don't know, because prior to that, you were on the other side. You were a member of the MEC, I think, prior to this. But do you recall the ISAC? Prior to that, of having the kind of customer service focus that you have today?
Look, I think some people may not agree with this. I think this is an evolution the entire sector has made, right? I think utilities are not always the most customer service oriented organizations, but I think they've recognized the need to do that, right? So communicating during storms, communicating during other significant events, right? Ratepayers are customers, and you have to treat them that way, right? So, I've always felt strongly about this. And look, we given the continuing evolution of the threat landscape, we have to stay ahead of that, and we have to, take stock of how we are doing what we're doing and making sure we're providing value.
So you're slated to retire in the near future. This is the second time you're retiring, so you kind of so far suck at it. What's next? What's next for you, Manny?
I don't really have any specific plans. I'm going to take a little bit of a break and do some traveling, but I suspect I'll stay engaged in some way. I'm always interested. I always do want to help, but no specific plans yet. And as soon as I know, I'll make sure I let you know. But I look forward to staying in touch, right? I've made a lot of great friendships. I've learned a lot from people like you and benefited from knowing, folks and not only your colleagues in Electricity Canada, but the folks in the Canadian government agencies as well as the utilities. I really cherish those relationships, and I'm grateful for the benefits they provided me throughout my career. So more to come.
Wow. Okay. Well, I can't let you off the hook, because the one thing I do ask everybody who comes on the podcast is for a book recommendation. And so we gather all of the book recommendations and put them together on our Flux Capacitor book club. So, Manny, what book would you add to the listeners' reading list?
So I just recently read a book that is called Radical Candor. It's been around. It's by Kim Scott. It's been around for a while. She just released a new edition. She's an expert in sort of providing feedback to folks, and I've always felt anybody who works in a leadership capacity, and it doesn't mean that you have to be running the organization. You could actually be a person within the organization. We all have responsibility to give feedback to each other in a honest, constructive way. And I think she does a great job. And, having been at this as long as I have, I even learned something there. So it's something that I encourage all my folks to take a look at. And then if you don't mind, I know you only asked for one. I try to read, a leadership book, and I try to, read something, entertaining fiction or whatever. So Demon Copperfield by Barbara Kingsolver was great book, really well written, great story, a little troubling at times, but very enjoyable book.
Okay, so the two book recommendations are Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver, and then your first one, and I hadn't heard of this book before, so I'm going to go out and pick it up. Radical Candor, the subtitle is How to Get What You Want by Saying What You Mean by Kim Scott. Both sound like really, really terrific additions to our book club. Manny, I want to thank you for taking the time to jump on the podcast finally, and we talked about it for quite some time. Did finally get you on before you exited the ISAC, but I suspect we may be talking again soon, depending upon what you do next. So thanks for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Francis, and thanks again to you and everybody up in Canada. I really appreciate the engagement and look forward to continued engagement. So, have a great holiday season.
For those that have been with the podcast since the beginning, And for those that have joined along the way, thanks for listening. I hope that what you've been able to glean from these conversations has been new insights and greater understanding of the complexity and challenges of ensuring that electricity continues to be delivered reliably and affordably to Canadian homes and businesses in this time of great change. Tune in for future episodes. Please take the time to rate the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen, and let me know what you think of the flux capacitor. You can find me through our website at electricity.ca, on LinkedIn, and on Instagram as The Brad Bradley. The website for this pod is thefluxcapacitor.ca, and it includes links for this episode on the show page, this being episode 103. And while you're there, check out the book club page, which provides info on and links to the books which have been recommended by guests on the Flux Capacitor, including Manny's Recommendations, Radical Candor, How to Get What You Want by Saying What You Mean by Kim Scott, and Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver. And let's continue the electricity conversation on our Facebook page, on Instagram, and at electricity.ca.